New Jersey Governor Chris Christie's State of the State speech today had themes we've heard on the campaign trail recently.
Here in New Jersey, we've achieved historic reforms, and our state has never been better prepared to face the future. Leaders who step up and take risks can make the biggest difference. Let's not start taking steps backwards. Now, Washington, that's not true. All we're going to hear tonight about the big challenges we face as a nation is a lot of hot air, not only from Congress, but from the White House as well. The State of the Union will not be a call to action tonight. It'll be a fantasy wish list by a president who's failed us.
I'm Tom McDonald, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Dave Heller is off this evening. Joining me to review the governor's performance is John Reitmeier. He's budget and public finance writer at njspotlight.com. John, though billed as a state of the state, was this essentially a presidential stump speech?
Yeah, certainly the speech today was delivered in Trenton, but for sure the issues that the governor touched on and stressed in the speech tied in nicely with the themes of his campaign. You know, he attacked President Obama and Congress. He talked about repealing a major tax. He railed against public employees. A lot of the similar points that he's been hitting as he's tried to gain traction as a national candidate over the last several months.
As a matter of fact, Christie came out swinging against a proposed constitutional amendment that requires payments into the public pension system, saying all the state's other expenses, education, public safety, health care, everything would take a back seat. He called it, in his words, a road to ruin, said huge increases in either income or sales taxes would be needed to fund it, and then placed the blame squarely on the legislators in the room. Let's listen to the governor.
Who are you going to steal the money from in New Jersey? Now, please don't tell me millionaires. Don't further insult the intelligence of New Jerseyans, because I'm going to give it to them straight. Take your millionaire surcharge, $600 million. On the best day of the year, it's $600 million. So, even a lawyer can do this math. Where do you go for the other $2.4 billion?
John, how'd that play in the state capitol?
Well, I can tell you from speaking to lawmakers afterward, not very well.
Now, remember, we're a family radio station.
Especially on the other side of the aisle. And what they'll say is what Christie did not say in the speech today is that in 2011, he agreed with lawmakers in a landmark reform bill that sought to do a number of things to shore up the pension system, but one of them was to increase state funding. He ended up not living up to that promise, even though employees are paying more. In addition, the schedule that the lawmakers have proposed as part of this constitutional amendment that they want to put before voters in November includes a good deal of a schedule that Christie has put out himself to get the pension system back on track here in New Jersey. So certainly lawmakers were unhappy to hear the governor vilify the constitutional amendment without acknowledging that they used some of his own numbers, and also that we wouldn't be in the predicament that we're in right now in New Jersey if Christie had lived up to the promise that he made in 2011 in terms of funding the pension system.
And put the money in year after year instead of holding back, as he had been saying. He did mention a few scare tactics, I would say, or 10% sales tax, 20-plus percent increase in the state wage tax to fill the hole. I imagine that's not playing too well either.
Well, and again, if we get to the details for just a second, what the constitutional amendment proposes is a ramp up to those bigger numbers, not all in one big payment. So the notion that this would all be accomplished in one big payment did not tell the whole story. And in addition, when we talk about the state budget in general, New Jersey has a large structural deficit. So in essence, everything is sort of competing against each other because politicians here have promised more than they have the money to pay for.
And with elections coming up in 2 years, everybody's going to be ramping up for that too.
And we already see that in the state house now. You have Democrats getting ready to run when the governor reaches his term limit. And you have lawmakers already jockeying to fill the leadership void that's been created by Christie's frequent absences as he runs for the president last year and into this year now.
And you're also going to see people who are going to run to replace Christie coming out of the woodwork anytime now.
We've already seen that. We've seen some of the prominent Democrats, including Senate President Steve Sweeney, a Democrat from South Jersey, stepped forward. He's the sponsor of the constitutional amendment on pension funding, and already start to take public positions in anticipation of 2017, which is a long way away, but in political life, it's really not that far away.
Real quick, John, one of the other things the governor brought up was drug treatment, talking about converting a closed prison into a drug treatment facility.
Yeah, and this was a big theme today, and it's something that Christie has used effectively both here in New Jersey and on the campaign trail nationally to sort of soften his image. He has stressed and has passed a number of different initiatives to change the way New Jersey does drug treatment, handles nonviolent drug offenders, and it was something that was heavily emphasized again in today's speech, and it's been something, you know, his image was created for many by the Bridgegate scandal, and he's effectively used this issue to sort of soften his image and connect with voters.
John Reitmeier from NJ Spotlight, thank you very much for joining us on Newsworks tonight.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
Philadelphia's two daily papers have been bought and sold plenty. Now they're being given away. WHYY's Dave Davies says the paper's owner, Jerry Lenfest, has a plan he thinks will keep quality journalism alive at the Inquirer, Daily News, and Philly.com.
At a news conference announcing the move, Lenfest recalled when he sold his cable TV business and made a fortune.
I had more money than I ever thought I would have, and I felt money is a responsibility when you have that kind of wealth.
Lenfest's given to many causes, but he says he's most proud of trying to preserve the quality of the city's two daily papers. He's decided to give the company that owns the Inquirer, Daily News, and Philly.com to a newly created nonprofit, the Institute for Journalism in New Media. It can do something the old for-profit company couldn't, except foundation grants to fund their reporting.
Charitable organizations, even the public, they could have memberships and so forth and give to the Institute as a tax-free organization.
Lenfest says nothing will change for readers and union contracts with existing employees remain in effect. Howard Gensler, president of the union representing reporters and editors, says there's concern in the newsroom that private interests funding journalism invites conflicts of interest.
Depending on how grants are decided and where money for the Institute comes from, it certainly could impact coverage, even if it's not intended to. There are always ramifications when people give money for something.
David Boardman, dean of Temple University's School of Media and Communications, is on the board of the new institute.
I think this is constructed in a way that builds some very strong curtains that protect the news organizations from any conflicts. I'm not concerned about that.
Meanwhile, the papers continue their efforts to save money. The Daily News has closed its City Hall Bureau. Dave Davies, WHYY News.
The battle's gone on for decades, but the subject of affordable housing in New Jersey remains very much unsettled. And just this week, the two sides fighting over affordable housing pulled even further apart. WHYY's Joe Hernandez has the story.
It's housing activists versus towns. The activists say that towns should be required to provide a generous stock of affordable housing for low-income residents. But towns say the activists' estimates of needed homes are too high and unreasonable. A new report commissioned by a group of towns offers one estimate of how much affordable housing New Jersey should build by 2026, and it's about a fifth of what activists say is needed.
We weren't surprised by it.
Kevin Walsh runs the Fair Share Housing Center in Cherry Hill.
The municipalities in New Jersey, many of the wealthier ones anyway, have been fighting meeting their fair share obligations for decades, and they found some experts that would help them do that.
The report by Philadelphia firm eConsult says the state needs about 38,000 new affordable homes over the next 10 years. A previous estimate by the Fair Share Housing Center put that number at just over 200,000. Michael Serra with the New Jersey State League of Municipalities says the eConsult findings are much more reasonable. He says the fact that the report was even drafted at all shows a willingness from the towns to meet their obligations under the Fair Housing Act.
These municipalities dug into their own pockets and paid for a report and a methodology in order to comply with their affordable housing obligations. They should not be criticized for doing that. They should be commended.
But in the coming months, many of these municipalities will have to take their affordable housing plans before local courts, which will ultimately have the final say on how many homes should be built. From the New Jersey desk, I'm Joe Hernandez, WHYY News.
Taking a look at today's headlines, Pennsylvania House of Representatives has voted to stop Governor Tom Wolf's use of a formula that targets extra subsidy money for school districts hardest hit by past spending cuts. Representatives voted today to amend the fiscal code bill, important companion legislation to the state budget. The bill now goes back to the Senate. State government is operating on a partial budget amid a partisan stalemate now in its seventh month. Wolf has released about half the school money through a hybrid formula that provides larger shares to districts hurt most by cuts made by his predecessor, Tom Corbett. Republicans say Wolf lacks authority to do that. They contend subsidies over last year's levels should be distributed through a formula that a bipartisan commission crafted last year came up with. New Jersey lawmakers have given a final approval today to a bill that would allow experimental oyster colonies in polluted waters in an effort to improve them. The state has prohibited such colonies, fearing poachers could introduce potentially tainted seafood into the market. The bill allows environmental and research groups to establish colonies in polluted waters as long as the colonies are invisible to and not easily accessible by the public. The bill now goes to Governor Chris Christie. Taking a look at the weather, tonight cloudy with the possibility of a rain or a snow shower with a low of 27. Wednesday, sunshine, a high of 30 degrees. Still ahead, an art installation at Temple University explores the impact a school closing has on its surrounding neighborhood.
Everything happened for a reason, and there is a social and political implication to those decisions. And to be a little bit more aware.
That's coming up as NewsWorks Tonight continues.
Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. It took Beethoven 4 years to compose, and yet it remains one of Beethoven's most seamless, most poetic works. Jan Lisiecki joins Yannick Nézet-Séguin for Fourth Concerto. Plus, the massed strings of the Philadelphia Orchestra play Beethoven's Serioso Quartet. Tickets online or by phone, 215-893-1999. This Wednesday, Friday, and Saturday at the Kimmel Center. Beethoven's Fourth Piano Concerto with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
Prices in San Francisco and Silicon Valley have people and companies moving across the bay to Oakland, where they are trying and where they have to do things differently.
There is no great model that I can look to and say, see, it was done here.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Turns out there is some there. There? It's next time on Marketplace from 8 p.m.
Tonight at 6:30 on WHYY.
Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Tom McDonald, in for Dave Heller. The news, including here on WHYY, is full of stories related to the growing number of people addicted to opioid pills and heroin. Even presidential candidates, such as New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, make comments on it that go viral. In this edition of That's History, Jonathan Zimmerman, professor of history at New York University, says while addiction is a horrible problem, he's disturbed by the racial implications of the coverage and attention. Welcome, Jonathan.
Good to be here.
Jonathan, what concerns you about the significant coverage of heroin and opioid abuse and addiction?
I think it's wonderful that politicians who formally said that we should just lock up people are talking more about prevention and treatment. The troubling part is the timing of all of this and the racial dimension. We've got to remember that nationwide, the heroin epidemic has become increasingly white. We think that 90% of people who tried heroin for the first time in the past decade were white. So it's impossible not to conclude that some of this new sympathy for heroin addicts does have to do with race, because in earlier eras where we associated heroin with other populations, you didn't see the same sympathy.
So it's about which people with drug addictions receive sympathy and which are portrayed as threats or criminals.
Yeah, I mean, and I think historically that's the best way to understand our attitudes towards drugs. They do change over time, but they change because of who does the drug. In the mid-19th century, the people that did opiates were largely middle-class white people. They were Civil War veterans for whom it was prescribed for what we would call PTSD. And they were often upper middle class white women, and it was prescribed for, you know, neurasthenia or weak nerves, things like that. But when it became associated with Chinese immigrants who smoked it in this scary place called an opium den, then it became a much more dangerous substance. The idea was if a white middle class person is doing it, we don't have to worry about it as much. But if Chinese people are in what was essentially depicted as the crack house of the late 19th century, then you see demands for restriction and control.
And one of the things in your essay spoke about how when Coca-Cola, the beverage, came out, there were descriptions of who was addicted and who wasn't addicted.
Well, yeah, and this is another good illustration, I think, of the principle that the way we judge a drug has to do with who does it. Where do we get Coca-Cola from? Well, a Civil War veteran and a morphine addict from Georgia, whose name was John Pemberton, he tried to capitalize on this growing fad in Europe of cocaine-laden wines. And he had quite a bit of success, but then it becomes controversial. Why? He starts bottling it. Why is that controversial? Because now for the first time, African Americans can drink it. It was formerly served at soda fountains, and because of Jim Crow and segregation, they're barred from it. Now they can drink it, and then suddenly you see a very different attitude and fear and panic. What's it called? The cocaine Negro. And again, this builds on and echoes some of the worst kind of racial fantasies and falsehoods in our culture. And very quickly, Coca-Cola is persuaded to remove cocaine from the product.
New Jersey Governor Chris Christie has been talking about drug addiction as part of his campaign and the need to expand treatment for several years. Is this something more than a politician looking for publicity?
You know, all politicians want votes. But it seems to me that in this instance, what the voters are telling them is indeed the drug war has failed and we need a different approach. And I think it's great that they're putting one forward. But I think you do see race still working in the way we think about other drugs, especially cocaine. Let's think about powder and crack cocaine.
Right.
They're both illegal. But despite the efforts of the president and Eric Holder when he was attorney general, there are still disparate sentences for those two products. And I would submit to you that there's a very simple reason. African Americans are more likely to use the crack form and whites the powdered form.
Thanks, Jonathan.
Thanks. It was fun.
Jonathan Zimmerman is professor of history at New York University. Every empty building has a story to tell. When it comes to a school, it's a whole neighborhood of stories. That's what inspired artist Pepon Ansorio when he saw an empty school in his North Philadelphia neighborhood. The result is a year-long large installation at Temple University's Tyler School of Art called Reform. WHYY's Elizabeth Perez Luna reports.
You know, so you walk in and what you see is on all four walls, you know, you see big pieces of composition paper, you know, with like essays, which we all wrote on it.
Linos Casanta graduated from Fairhill Elementary a year before it closed forever in 2013. She describes the exhibition that brought her school to Temple University's Tyler School of Art.
And then there's like this cage with like iPads, and we all did this video. We read like this poem that a friend of mine wrote, and we all have like parts of it.
It's time that when we speak, you listen.
It's just talking about like things that we went through because of them. Like there's like we had some people who their siblings graduated, but they didn't get to graduate because they took the school from them. You know, some people don't see their friends anymore, like things like that.
Santa is one of the 10 former students calling themselves the Bobcat Collective, who worked with artist Pepon Ansorio to recreate the shuttered classrooms and hallways in this immersive work. Ansorio is a prominent installation artist and a former social worker. He teaches at Tyler. The exhibit includes a cardboard depiction of the Philadelphia School District's headquarters and figurines of Superintendent William Height. The films, photos, audio, multimedia, and other objects have one purpose, says Ansorio.
It's an opportunity to reflect and to be able to understand education and to move education into a higher priority.
And for the students, it's an opportunity.
For them to understand that everything happened for a reason, and there is a social and political implication to those decisions, and to be a little bit more aware.
There are messages everywhere, from ceiling to floor, and Osorio even includes a water fountain with a "do not drink water" sign on it, as can be found in some Philadelphia schools. On the side of the large room, tall towers the size of lockers act as totem poles, which include different personal objects from students, and an iPad that shows them telling their stories.
But how can we do better if there are only a few public schools with enough materials for a few classes and teachers barely getting paid?
Pepón Osorio's work is never simple or isolated from his belief in social fairness and equality. Once he comes up with an idea, dozens of people become part of the collective process, and the artwork is a community happening. In one of his installations, he built a transparent house in the style of the Puerto Rican casitas, made up of photos of North Philly families printed in glass. Another of his installations took place in a crowded neighborhood barbershop, all places where people can gather and talk.
No, like, that's my school, because I've been there forever. I went there since I was, like, in pre-K. And I was, like, the last class to graduate from that school in 2010.
In this project, Reform, he wanted to tap into a sense of loss for students and their families.
It's a little sad, because 304, you're used to seeing the kids running around, you know, causing trouble. And then now you walk, like, on a school day, you just walk by and it's just empty. Like, there's no one there. Like, it's so...
Fairhill was one of about two dozen Philadelphia schools closed down in 2013. So this is a story familiar to many other neighborhoods and cities.
I always start the work with three words. And the words that I was started the work at the very, very beginning was, coincidentally, despair, loss, and pain. There is a sense of that. There's a presence of loss. There's a presence of despair around here.
Osorio sees a common thread in these closings.
Coincidence that it always happens in places where there's a lot of poverty. You know, it always happens in the places that people are the most fragile. And all that is connected, one thing with the others.
Pepón Osorio's installation, Reform, will remain at Temple University's Tyler School of Art until May. Who knows? You might meet some of the Bobcats doing their high school homework there. Elizabeth Perez Luna, WHYY News.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Binyakov and Kimberly Haas. Host Dave Heller returns tomorrow evening. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom McDonald for NewsWorks Tonight.
The Wistar Institute, a proud supporter of WHYY, presents Nikon Small World, a photo exhibition highlighting the stunning world from under the microscope. Wistar is the only regional host of the 2015 Nikon Small World winners, featuring 20 very best in microscopic photography from around the world. What appear to be abstract works of art showing alien planets and mind-bending color palettes are in reality tools that scientists use to learn more about our world. On January 15th, there will be a special opening reception. Find out more at wistar.org/NSW2016.